But how did that happen? How was I forced to pull an all-nighter while at Cal Poly? Well, let me tell you. I was assigned some kind of 15-page paper, about a subject that I was uninterested in, about a book that I found boring. And, necessarily, what's going to happen? I'm going to pull an all-nighter. And, of course, if you take my innate sense of procrastination and combine that with the fact that I'm a perfectionist, yeah, that's definitely going to result in an all-nighter. But you see, I haven't had that problem so far at Western Seminary. I'm a seminary student now going to Bible school, and I'm absolutely loving it. Seminary is changing my life. It's an amazing experience. I love what I'm learning. My professors, such a privilege to learn from them, although I wonder if they might not feel as privileged to have me as their student. When I turn in a 19-page paper that was supposed to be 7 to 10 pages. Guilty. Guilty of that. And I didn't spend all night writing it. But what's the difference between Cal Poly David and Western David? I worked hard at Cal Poly. I really did. But the thing is, I was working to get a grade. Not because my heart was in it. But you see, at Western, I work hard because I love what I'm learning. And I love who I'm learning about. It's, if you want to use these terms, it's kind of like an obedience from the heart. Because I want to. Because it's part of my nature to do so. And I think it's just this difference between the Cal Poly obedience and the Western obedience that Jesus is teaching about here in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, here it is. Sermon on the Mount is 3 chapters, 5, 6, and 7. I invite you to open your Bibles up to chapter 5 of the book of Matthew. We're going to look at a section in the Sermon on the Mount starting in verse 21. Now, I've arranged it for you in these pretty 6 boxes to demonstrate the way that the book is divided. It's structured into 6 sections. You see the introduction there in the first half of chapter 5, the conclusion in the last half of chapter 7. And the introduction, Jonathan has been taking us through these last couple weeks. He started teaching us through the Beatitudes, and then last week we learned that as the church of God's people, we are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And then there was this curious passage about the law. And that passage, right before this latter half of chapter 5, is meant to set up this next section of Jesus' teaching. Now, this section on the law began with these words. "Do not think," Jesus said, "do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. No, I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Now, we learned in our growth group questions this last week that when Jesus says, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law," that implies that there were some people that thought that that's what he was here to do. And more importantly for this morning, that there was some material coming in his sermon, what he was about to say, which might be undermined, some people might think Jesus was undermining the law. Therefore, he said, "No, do not think that that's what I'm doing." You see, what comes next? What's this next section in the Sermon on the Mount that some people might think is Jesus undermining the law? Well, next section in the Sermon on the Mount is a section called Jesus's Antitheses. Now, that's a hard word to pronounce, and I'm probably going to stumble over it more than once this morning, but it's pretty easy to understand, the idea of the antitheses. You're going to see 6 statements in the Sermon on the Mount that look like this. You have heard that it was said, and then something that resembles Old Testament teaching, and then Jesus says, "But I say to you." You've heard that it was said, "But I say to you." Now, what is not happening here? What is distinctly not happening here? Jesus is not rejecting Old Testament law. Now, there's six of these antitheses on these six subjects: murder, adultery, divorce, lying, eye for an eye, love your neighbor. The Old Testament has some teaching on those subjects, and Jesus is going to address them. But what he's not going to do, he's not going to reject Old Testament law. Rather, he's going to rescue the true meaning, the true intent of that law from what had become the false manipulation, the false teaching of the scribes and Pharisees of that day. That's why he says, "You have heard that it was said," as opposed to "it is written." So, Jesus came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And he fulfills it in his person, in the fulfillment of prophecy and reliving Israel's history, and he fulfills it in his teaching, taking the true intention of the law back from the Pharisees, who had reduced it to a kind of shallow, empty rule-keeping, like getting A's at Cal Poly. And Jesus is going to return it to what it should be, a radical overhauling of our entire attitude and character and orientation to God and man. So open your Bibles. We're going to cover the first three of Jesus' antitheses this week, and in a few weeks, Jonathan's going to take you through the next three. So starting in Matthew 5:21. "You have heard that our ancestors were told, 'You must not murder. If you commit murder, you are subject to judgment. But I say, if you are even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you call someone an idiot, you are in danger of being brought before the court. If you curse someone, you are in danger of the fires of hell. So, if you are presenting a sacrifice at the altar in the temple and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice there at the altar and go. Be reconciled to that person. Then come and offer your gift to God. When you are on the way to the court with your adversary, settle your differences quickly. Otherwise, your accuser may hand you over to the judge, who will hand you over to an officer, and you will be thrown in prison. And if that happens, you surely won't be free again until you have paid the last penny. You have heard that the commandment says, 'You must not commit adultery.' But I say, anyone who even looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So if your eye, even your good eye, causes you to lust, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your hand, even your stronger hand, causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown in hell. You've heard that the law says, a man can divorce his wife by merely giving her a written certificate of divorce. But I say that a man who divorces his wife, unless she has been unfaithful, causes her to commit adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." So we are going to walk through these first three antitheses one at a time. Firstly, thou shalt not murder. You've heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment." Now, this is taken roughly from the sixth commandment of the Ten Commandments, and we've already established that what's going to happen, the pattern here in the antitheses, Jesus is going to be responding to some bad teaching by the Pharisees on, in this case, the sixth commandment. So, what does the sixth commandment have to do with the Pharisees? How are they twisting it a little bit? Well, what are they going to say in response to this sixth commandment? "Of course I've kept this commandment," they'll say. "Of course. I mean, of the Ten Commandments, this is the easy one, isn't it? I mean, do not covet. Yeah, that one's a little bit tough. Honor your father and mother. Okay, I messed up on that one a few times growing up. Don't lie. Well, I just tell the white variety, so it can't be that bad. But murder? I'm not a murderer. Okay, Jesus says. You've kept the sixth commandment. Let me tell you what the sixth commandment is really all about, the true intent of the sixth commandment. You've heard that it was said, you shall not murder. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Do you see how this works? I mean, let's just say I'm angry. I'm angry with you. I'm angry that you're here. I'm angry simply that you're in my life, and I wish that you weren't. I wish that you would go away. You make my life so hard. I wish that I could erase you from my life. And there you go. Murder committed in the heart. We're not talking here about premeditated homicide. No, Jesus is talking about that kind of strong dislike that we have for someone, that every time we see them, every time we're in their presence in the same room, our blood starts to boil. And, you know, we never admit it, probably, but we harbor thoughts and feelings that resemble something kind of like hatred. Now, we have to remember what Jesus is doing here with these commandments. He's restoring their true intent. Jesus is really after, he's truly after an eternal heart obedience to the true intent of the law. And what's the true intent of the sixth commandment? It's a heart completely free of hatred. Now, maybe there's no one that you hate this morning, but is there anyone you're angry with? Anyone maybe you wish wasn't in your life? Makes things so difficult? Maybe someone you've said some mean things to or would like to say some mean things to. Well, Jesus addresses this next expression of anger in the following verses. Whoever insults, he says, whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, you fool, will be liable of the hell of fire. Now, how does that work? Why? Well, Jesus is going to later teach that from the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. God is after your heart. He wants for your heart to align with his kingdom. Jesus is next going to give us a couple of examples stressing the absolute urgency of being reconciled with our brothers. He'll say, if you are offering your gift there at the altar, and remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Now, these words, offering your gift, is most likely referring to what was called a free will offering. So when you go to the temple in Jerusalem and you give your sacrifice to God as an act of worship. So what's being described here is worship. And I wonder if you guys have ever found this to be the case in your lives, that you can't worship God with a full heart when your heart is harboring bitterness towards someone else. Be reconciled, Jesus says. He gives a second example. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to the court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out till you've paid the last penny. There are serious consequences, Jesus teaches, to a heart that is constantly at war with its fellow man. Jesus' kingdom is a kingdom of peace. And he's the prince of that kingdom. So I urge you to take a moment and think seriously. Is there anyone that you are in conflict with this morning? Maybe somebody that you've wronged or somebody that's wronged you? Romans 12 tells us that if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. See how it introduces that? So far as it depends on you, do everything that you can. But once you've reached that point, you can only do what you can do. But Jesus expects you to go there, to try. And how are such people described by Jesus? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Our next antithesis is about the seventh commandment. We just looked at the sixth commandment. Now we're on to number seven. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. So what game do you suppose the Pharisees are playing with this seventh commandment? I suppose it's probably the same as the sixth. Of course I haven't committed adultery, the Pharisees will say. I haven't touched another man's wife. Okay, good, Jesus says. Your hands haven't touched. But what about your eyes? What kind of touching have your eyes done? You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her. And where? Where did this act of adultery take place? In his heart. So if anger is equivalent with murder in the kingdom economy, it seems that lust is equivalent with adultery. But I want you to take a look at something here. It seems to me that Jesus is addressing specifically men here in this verse. Now, of course, lust is a problem that men and women struggle with, but it says that every man who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her. Now, while it applies to both, I think that the wording here is intentional. And I'll tell you why. But first, I can't get through a sermon without a reference to a country song. So try this one on for size. Here's some of the lyrics. Every time I see a woman on a billboard sign, I think about you, saying, drink this beer and you'll be mine. I think about you. When I see a pretty woman walking down the street, I think about you. Men look her up and down like she's some kind of treat. I think about you. She wouldn't dare talk to a stranger, always has to be aware of the danger. Doesn't matter who she is, I think about you. Then it transitions to the chorus. I think about you. 8 years old, big blue eyes and a heart of gold. When I look at this world, I think about you. And I can't help but see that every woman used to be somebody's little girl. I think about you. So what's this song's solution to lust? Men, when you see that woman jogging down the street, or at the gym, or at work, or on the television screen, or perhaps your computer, remember, she's somebody's daughter. Think of her as your own, perhaps, if that helps. But you know, this isn't just country music wisdom I'm sharing with you. Paul gives similar advice to Timothy. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, Paul is talking to another pastor, Timothy, and he's like, all right, this is how I want you to interact with the people in your congregation. He says, do not rebuke older women or older men. Rather, encourage older men as you would fathers. Encourage younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters in all purity. Think of them, treat them as you would your sister. Love them, defend them. But what does all this have to do? What does all this have to do with Jesus addressing men here in verse 28 of his sermon? Well, remember the lyrics to that song? Men, look her up and down like she's some kind of treat. She wouldn't dare talk to a stranger, always has to be aware of the danger. You know, that may be true in this world, tragically, but it will not be true in the church. The kingdom, the church, will be a place that is safe for women, where they are honored, where they are cherished, where they're defended. But what if you struggle with lust? Well, Jesus, he wants to help you. He gives you some advice. He continues in verse 29, if your right eye causes you to sin, cut it off. It's better that you lose it than that you go into hell. What about your right hand? Well, if it's causing you to sin, I'd recommend you to cut it off. It's better that you lose that hand than that you go into hell. What Jesus is doing with these rather abrasive words, he's stressing the absolute urgency of dealing with this internal corruption of the heart, recognizing the very real possibility of eternal consequences if this fire is left to burn unchecked. So, right eye, right hand, what's this all about? Obviously, they're metaphors. I mean, if you get out the blade on the butcher block and you cut off your hand, is that really going to solve the problem of your lust? No. So, the hand and the eye, they're metaphors. What are they metaphors for in your life? Could they be perhaps a television show that you've grown to like? I wonder, is that show really worth it? Oh, come on, the nudity is only very brief, and gosh, they hardly show anything at all. And I swear, every time I fast forward through it, and, you know, it's actually kind of tastefully done, to be honest. Well, Jesus, he sees straight through all of that nonsense, and he says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." And wouldn't you rather see God than all that stuff anyways? Our last antithesis brings us to a rather difficult subject, a subject that's probably affected everyone in this room to various degrees. Somebody in their family, perhaps, has been divorced, a close friend, themselves, or maybe their parents. So we're going to tread carefully. But before we do so, I urge you to put before you, to place before your eyes this vision of Jesus, remembering that Jesus is good and he's kind, that Jesus is humble and meek and lowly, that he is the lover of our souls, that none of his words are cruel or heartless, but all of them are good and kind. So remember that it is this Jesus that's speaking to us about this subject. Let's figure out what he has to say about divorce. But before we do so, what do the Pharisees say? Now, we know they're going to get it wrong, don't we? It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Now, what's the certificate business all about? Well, it's taken from some complicated case law out of Deuteronomy 24, which says that a man who's divorcing his wife for some indecency must present her with one of these certificates. But what's more important, I think, this morning for us to focus on is the perspective from which the Pharisees are addressing this question about divorce. It's a question that's going to come up again. Later in chapter 19, the Pharisees are going to broach this question to Jesus. Look what they ask. They came up to him, and they intend to test him and ask, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? See what they're trying to do? They're trying to justify walking out on their wives. And what's Jesus' response to that? Well, back in chapter 5, look what he says. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give him a certificate. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife Everyone who walks out on their wives, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Do you see what Jesus is doing? How he's responding to the Pharisees? What he's doing is he's protecting the woman. No, he says. No, you may not abandon your wife. The only reason you can leave her is if she has already abandoned the marriage in adultery. So, is divorce always sin? Well, yes, but it is not always sin for both parties. If your spouse has committed adultery, pursuing divorce is not a sin. And pay attention to this too. Paul gives us another exemption. In 1 Corinthians 7:15, he says, if the unbelieving partner separates, that is to say, if your spouse who's not a Christian wants to leave, if your unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. So if those are our exceptions, again, there's more important questions to deal with regards to divorce. Why do they happen in the first place? And, I mean, why is it that Moses seemed to legislate divorce here with this certificate? Well, again, this is a question that the Pharisees ask in chapter 19. Look what they say. The Pharisees said to Jesus, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and then to send her away? Well, Jesus says, it was because of your hardness of heart that Moses, he didn't command you, allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. Divorces happen in this fallen world because our hearts are messed up. They're hard. We don't know how to live with and to love another as we should, as Christ does. Now, marriage isn't easy. It certainly isn't easy. I mean, you take two sinful people, and you put them in a confined space, and you start shaking. And that's marriage, right? And then what do? You start adding financial pressures, and you squeeze the two of them, and maybe you drop one or two rebellious children in there and add some sleepless nights. And then, of course, there's the devil and his angels who want nothing more than to tear our marriages apart. It takes a soft heart to weather that storm. So here's our Sermon on the Mount and our antitheses. What holds them together? Well, we learned that murder is equivalent with anger, and that the anger lives in, it resides within our heart. And adultery, I mean, lust, Jesus taught, is adultery. And it's committed first, before it's committed in a hotel room, it's committed inside of our heart. And divorces tragically happen because of a hardness of heart. So what's the heart of the problem? The heart is the problem. The heart is the problem. What's then the solution? Now, if you say Jesus, you're almost there. You get partial credit. Why did Jesus come? What did Jesus come to do? Remember back in that statement about the law? I came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. I fulfill it, Jesus says, in my person, in my teaching, restoring that true intent. And there's one more. The Old Testament, the law, spoke of a day when God would do something new for his people. He would establish a new covenant. Jeremiah 31 teaches us about this new covenant. Look what it says. Behold, the days are coming when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. For this is the covenant I will make. I will put my law within them. I am going to write that law on your heart. He's talking about a radical transformation of the heart, a complete internalization of the good, gracious commands of God. Ezekiel 36 talks about that same covenant. I will give you a new heart, he says, and a new spirit I will put within you. I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh, one that beats. Finally, Deuteronomy 30, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring. He's going to cut away all of that stuff in you, that tendency to sin, that love for sin. He's going to remove it. And what's this new heart going to accomplish? This new heart that God is going to produce in you, what will it accomplish? Well, look at the very next verse in each of these references. Jeremiah 31. No longer shall each one teach his neighbor, saying, know the Lord, because they're all going to know me. You're going to know the Lord in a way that you've never known him before with this new heart. From the least to the greatest, they all will know me. When I put the new spirit within you with a new heart, I will cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules. This new heart is going to produce a new obedience, an obedience that's natural, that is just an overflowing of who we are. And finally, the circumcision of our heart, that open heart surgery, what's it going to do? So that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. So how does Jesus fulfill the law? Jesus fulfills the law by giving us a heart capable of keeping the law, of following after Jesus. We couldn't do it before, but with a new heart, we can. That's the new covenant. And what do we hear every communion Sunday? A couple weeks ago, Jonathan led us through communion here, and he read out of 1 Corinthians 11. He said, in the same way, Jesus took the cup after supper, saying, this is the new covenant in my blood. Do this in remembrance of me. What does that mean? If you are in Christ, you have that new heart beating in your chest. Now, does that mean you're never going to sin? One day it will. One day, holiness and righteousness will be so natural to you, it will be like breathing. You will perfectly reflect your Father. You will look just like Jesus. You won't have to try to love God and to love your neighbor. You're going to have to try to love God and neighbor about as hard as you have to try now to keep your heart beating. It's just going to be part of who you are. But what about today? Well, the new heart that you have beating in your heart today means that you have a new power over sin. You know, there's this curious passage out of 2 Peter chapter 1. It's almost passive-aggressive. You'll have to see if you agree with me on that score. It begins by saying, you have become partakers of the divine nature. Think new heart when you hear that. You've become partakers of the divine nature. And then he encourages you, therefore, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, knowledge with self-control, self-control with steadfastness, steadfastness with godliness, godliness with brotherly affection with love. And then there's this next line. Whoever lacks these qualities, those he just listed, whoever lacks these qualities is nearsighted, so nearsighted that he is blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed from former sins. So how's your memory this morning? What's the Spirit telling you? Is he maybe encouraging you to have a softer heart towards your spouse? Oh, that's impossible, you say. I've been stuck in this rut, in this relationship for so many years, I can't possibly get out of it. Have you forgotten that you've been cleansed from your former pattern of life? And that it is God himself who is softening your heart so that you can be soft towards others? Maybe the Spirit's telling you that you have got some metaphorical hands and some metaphorical eyes you got to cut off. Oh, that won't do any good, you say. The damage has already been done. This battle I'm struggling with lust, it's hopeless. Have you forgotten that you are no longer enslaved to sin, that you have been set free, you have a new nature? So fight the good fight. Or perhaps the Spirit is nudging you there on the ribs, kind of hurts. He's nudging you, and he's telling you, you know, there's somebody you need to go up to and say, I'm sorry. I've hurt you. I want to make things right. I want to be reconciled. Will you please forgive me? Oh, that would be the most humiliating conversation of my life. I can't do that. Well, maybe it'd be the best conversation of your life. And you know, you wouldn't go into that conversation empty-handed. Or have you forgotten that the same power that rose Jesus from the grave lives in you? So go. Show the world what it's like to have a new heart beating in your chest. Let's pray.